It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as gyms closed down for the pandemic, many people bought up whatever home fitness equipment they could find. We'll talk about what happens now to the fitness industry and whether all of those people are going to go back to their old routines. First, if you spent time in rural areas decades ago, there are probably sounds and maybe even particular species that stand out in your memory. But chances are, if you're still there, you go back to visit, you're seeing and hearing fewer of those creatures. It turns out there are a lot of different factors that have made it harder for wildlife and farming to share lands together. Our next guest says there's a lot we can do to feed people while still keeping a place for wildlife on and around farmland. John Marsliff is a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and is the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. John, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, I want to give a sound to the bird in your title there, an eastern meadowlark. Here's a listen. And that's a bird that is an emblem for a lot of the changes you've seen going on when it comes to wildlife in our agricultural areas. What is it about meadowlarks that stand out for you?
Well, a couple of things. They're pretty much obligate grassland nesters, and at least during the breeding season, that's where we see them up here in North America. Because they're so closely tied to grasslands, their populations have plummeted over the last several decades by up to 70% by some estimates. So they're a flagship for a species that is in decline in response to the way we've treated our grassland environments.
And growing up looking at farmland all the time, the change that's happened may not stand out to us. Can you talk about, over the last couple of centuries, how we've changed our grassland ecosystems around the United States?
Sure. And first, I think your point that these changes don't stand out so strongly to us is a good one. And the meadowlark's an example of that as well. You probably, most listeners have probably still heard or seen meadowlarks in the past years, but their numbers are greatly reduced. And that's because we've done things like plowed up an awful lot of the prairie and planted it with cereal crops. And in the upper Midwest, that's mostly corn and soybean as we get a little further south as well. So the change in that perennial grass to a annual cereal grain that's harvested and disturbed each year has reduced the ability of birds to nest in that environment.
And you write that even within agriculture in North America, we've had that change to that monoculture, these huge crops. In the past, was it more possible for wildlife, not just the meadowlark, but other species to survive on and around American farmland?
I would say it wasn't even more possible. It was exactly the norm there. When we had smaller farms, we had hedgerows between them. We had waterways and ponds that were left. Places that were difficult to work just weren't worked. And that was good for wildlife. They could find shelter there. There was less of a human footprint on the land.
But the big contradiction, the difficulty at the core of your book is we've got a lot of people on this planet. We keep having more and more people on the planet. How do we feed them while still leaving room for this kind of wildlife, either to live on our farmland or to live near it? How do you see that struggle shaping up in the 21st century?
I think it's going to be a struggle, and I think it's one of the grand challenges we face as a species. Unless we want to be left alone on this planet with our food, we need to do something to allow other forms of life to exist with us in these settings. And people talk about two basic strategies. The one you referred to of basically intensifying our use of the agricultural land so that we can set aside more natural lands for wildlife. And the other is to share our farmlands, not farm them so intensively, but kind of step back to the way it was in the 60s, 50s, where there was a lighter touch, more natural habitat interspersed with farmland, and a different attitude of farmers to enjoy and look for ways to coexist with the wildlife on their lands.
We're talking to John Marsliff about his new book, In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And John, I want to make it clear, in your book, you're not making farmers out to be the bad guy here. You see them as people wanting to steward their land, their soil, and their region. And you find a lot of them doing innovative things to make their farming practices more sustainable. Do you see a lot of hope coming from farmers themselves to be part of the solutions to the questions you're raising?
I absolutely do. All the farmers that I talk with, and I went to many farms here in the U.S. and Costa Rica, and in all of those cases, the farmers I met were enthusiastic about the animals and native plants on their lands, but they're faced with an economic challenge of making a living. And to do so in some settings requires them basically to work the land in a way that's not as conducive to wildlife as it once was. But they all look for ways to do it, and I found many very innovative, as you say, strategies to do so.
You point toward past success stories in dealing with challenges to the way we farm, and one is the reaction to the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, where farming practices were changed in kind of one of the agricultural heartlands of the United States to resist future droughts. Does that inspire you that as big as the challenges are, there is hope today?
Well, I think whenever we face those sorts of challenges, we do tend to rise to the occasion and innovate our way out of it. And I'm hopeful that we will continue to do that. It's more difficult when we're also trying to do that and conserve species that perhaps some feel are not so necessary for our being. I don't see it that way, but that makes it a more difficult situation than just growing more food for more people. But yeah, the Dust Bowl saw lots of conservation efforts put into place to save topsoil, to reduce its loss from wind, and that included planting of trees, leaving some unplowed areas, reducing tilling in general. All of those things are beneficial for the health of the land and for the wildlife that depends on it.
You look to a lot of people and institutions for solutions here. One of those groups is the consumer, people who eat food, which is, I guess, all of us. What kind of things would you invite people who eat food to think about when it comes to supporting this kind of sustainability?
Yeah, I think we can all play an important part here. And one of the first things I'd ask you to think about is, who's your farmer? Do you know them? Have you met them? Do you know how they treat their land and how they treat it with respect to harboring wildlife? I met a woman whose dad is a banana picker in Costa Rica, and I will only buy organic bananas now because of the stories from him of being doused with pesticides while he was working in the field of traditional big ag down there. So knowing the sorts of stresses that are on the farmer, how they cope with them, that can point us to buying certain types of food. And in general, one of the most important things we can do is think carefully about our choice of meat, especially. It has a huge effect on the environment, from climate change to the crops that are grown that are fed to our cattle in particular. So, again, from my standpoint, the more we can do to wean ourselves from grain-fed beef, the better we can do for the environment as well.
And then you look toward creating incentives for farmers with things like a conservation program in the U.S. Farm Bill. What kind of things would you like to see more of?
Yeah, that became very apparent as I talked with farmers that had a choice to put some of their lands into the Conservation Reserve Program or other sorts of programs like that, that allows them to fallow land or to plant it in ways that are more conducive to wildlife. They simply can't afford to do that. They make a lot less per acre than they would if they planted it in soy or corn. So rectifying that, paying for conservation and making it a fair trade to conserve versus to harvest the area is, I think, critical. And those of us who have a voice in our governing bodies should try to make that pitch strongly to them.
We're talking to ornithologist John Marsliff. He's a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. His latest book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. And we want to hear from you. Do you have memories of a time when a wide variety of birds and animals were present on farmland areas here in Wisconsin? Have you seen that change over the years? If you're a farmer yourself, do you try to keep your farm friendly to wildlife? If so, what do you do? If you're not able to, what kind of support would help you do that? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with John Marsliff. He's a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington. The book we're talking about is titled In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. You can tweet us with your thoughts. Would you be willing to pay more for food that you know is raised in a way that supports wildlife? How about reducing the amount of corn-fed meat that you eat? If you're a farmer, what incentives or support could help you be able to steward your land in a way that encourages wildlife? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and tell us what you think. We'll go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Adams. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was living out on a farm that was in the middle of big time soy and corn production, and we were getting dived by chemicals every hour of every day during the summer. It was horrible. But I bought a house in the city, and I think that people are living in some kind of despair about what they can do. I bought a house that's on a lot. It's 150 feet by 150 feet. I am digging up every speck of grass on this lot, and I am planting prairie. And I am going to invite this little oasis to be a place where wildlife and pollinators can come and be happy. And I think if everybody that could do that, because there are restrictions on it, but if everybody that could do that can do that, it's a little thing that you can do to make yourself feel better about this. You're not like just lost in this huge industrial farming complex that you can't control.
Chris, thanks for the call. John, she's doing it in her lot, but is there room for farmers to create those spaces, whether they're buffer zones or reserve areas, enough to make a difference?
Absolutely. And at your home is also a great place to start. There's no doubt about that. Every little bit helps. But on the farm, you've got more land to work with. So again, places that are difficult to work, point rows, those little triangles that are hard to get the plow down, leaving those and letting places like that go back to nature. The areas that aren't hit by the irrigation wheels can be places where a little bit of prairie can grow. And some of the birds, the smaller birds like savanna sparrows, can get by in small patches of prairie. Meadowlarks need a little bit larger patch.
Thanks for that call, Chris. Pete emailed us from Reedsburg. Pete says, I'm 65 and grew up in rural Richland County. In those years, birds like meadowlarks, whippoorwills, and red-headed woodpeckers were so common you barely noticed them. Today, Pete says, it's a memorable day when you see or hear even one. On the other hand, Pete says, hawks of all kinds were not very common back then. Today, they're all over the countryside, maybe because we stopped killing them indiscriminately. Shows we can make a difference if we try. What do you think of what Pete had to say, John?
Yeah, actually, it's absolutely right. Hawks have increased, but not the ones that require the grassland, like the northern harrier. That hawk has declined along with the other grassland birds. But with banning of DDT, hawk populations in general have increased greatly, and that's been a boon to that group of birds for sure. And it, as he says, it shows that some simple changes can, even though they seem difficult, imagine banning pesticides like DDT now, that change had profound effects.
Let's go back to our callers. Carlin is with us in Waukesha. Carlin, hi.
Hi. Just want to put in a plug for the monarch butterfly, because I think, the Environmental Defense Fund and everybody, I read information about it. The population has decreased by 90%, and it's the milkweed destruction. And that's where it used to live, was between the fields, the farmers' fields, and along our, along the roadways and everything. And because of herbicides and because of the way the farmers have to farm now, we don't have all that habitat anymore. So they're suffering a lot, and we need to plant more milkweed. So just putting in a plug for that, too, because...
Carlin, thanks a lot for the call. I know there's this effort in Wisconsin and elsewhere, John, to get farmers and road departments and homeowners do exactly what Carlin's talking about, bring back those milkweed patches.
Yeah, and a common place was in the ditches along roads, and that's an easy target for conservation, and the verges in the roads even.
That's an easy target. It's not one that's being farmed intensively right now. And a little bit of change there could, again, make a big difference.
Thanks for that call. Back to your calls. Willem is on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I live in a rural community. I'm surrounded by farms, and I've lived here for 30 years, and I remember when we first moved here, I used to see a lot more meadowlarks and bobolinks and birds that are sort of nesters, grass nesters, but they've started to cut the hay so early these days. So I'm not blaming them. That's probably a necessity on their part. But this early harvesting of hay, the first cutting, is usually before the nesting birds, grass nesting birds, have a chance to fledge and leave the nest. So a lot of them are killed in that process. And then I used to also hear a lot of whippoorwills, and I haven't heard a whippoorwill. I bet you it's been 10 years. And I think that that has to do with wetland destruction, which is also, you know, wetlands being converted to different types of land use. And the other bird that I've disappeared from seeing very often are red-headed woodpeckers. So there are many birds that are disappearing. It's just that a lot of people either don't notice or, you know, I guess they just don't notice.
Well, thanks for the call. And, John, I wonder sometimes as you're talking to people, do they have that moment like, yeah, I never thought about it. I used to see these guys, these birds all the time. Now I never do.
Yes, all the time. I think, and especially a bird like the bobolink is another great example, like the meadowlark. But the bobolink is a species that kids grew up with 40, 50 years ago. And it was common. It was kind of a herald of spring. And it was look forward to seeing that bird back, and that's been missing. And in fact, it is because of these early harvests of hay fields and some of the grasslands that are harvested for cattle feed as well. But there are some very innovative programs out there targeting these species, paying farmers to delay their harvest in California and in New England. This is working well. So farmers, again, if we incentivize the right sorts of things, they're more than happy to do this. And still are able to make a living, and the bobolinks and other species are able to survive as well.
Willem, thanks for that call. We're talking to John Marsliff. His new book is In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. One thing that struck me in your book, John, I think this is in Nebraska, not just a decline in species diversity, but in the number of humans in farming communities. We hear about rural decline in Wisconsin. I think you were in Nebraska where there were these once thriving, vibrant farming communities. Now they have way fewer people and way less going on thanks to the way agriculture has changed.
Yeah, I went to Ong, Nebraska, a small place that I would never have heard of except that my mother-in-law grew up there as a farm kid. And boy, it was a great place back in the day. As we drove through with her, you could see the life just drained out of her as we looked at the churches that were abandoned, all the abandoned buildings, all the favorite places and memories of her childhood basically had just been left to decay. As people have moved to cities, as farms are being owned by fewer and fewer people, big corporations don't have all the houses on the land that used to be there that supported the smaller individual farmer and the need for these smaller rural towns. So there's a dramatic shift across the middle U.S. for sure.
Let's bring on one more caller. Mary Kay is with us now in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi, I called the DNR last year. The birds and the bees are disappearing because of pesticide applications, toxic pesticide applications. They don't want anything to do with that land. So when we have safer pesticides, which I'm sure the DNR has already issued, we're going to see them come back.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. John, just that direct impact, do we see that of pesticides on the wildlife?
I agree with that. In Nebraska, I plotted that trend out because we measure the number of acres that are treated with pesticides each year in the U.S., and that number has increased dramatically in association with decline of grassland birds. But we have also greatly reduced the amount of habitat out there. So if they're hand in hand, and I agree, safer pesticides, if such a thing exists, would be good. But there's a lot of natural ways to deal with pests. And a lot of the farmers I talked with are employing those, from having bluebirds and owls on their property to eat pests to other sorts of plants that have pesticide benefits.
You refer to a Wisconsinite, Aldo Leopold, a few times in your book, including his charge to remake agriculture in a way that increases the, what he called, stability, integrity, and beauty of the planet. How do you see that spirit maybe being a guidepost to the future?
I think it'd be the most fantastic guidepost we could have. And I met some farmers here. I thought I was talking to Leopold a few times with the way these people work their land. They really see it as a community, not solely a commodity, which, again, is an important point that Leopold made. So I think it'd be a fabulous standard for us to try to live up to. If only more of us did, I think the world would be a much better place.
John, in our last couple minutes, it seems like it would be easy to be pessimistic. We've got this growing demand for food with more people, concern over climate change, agriculture's impact on it, how it's going to affect our farming in the future. Having gone through the experience of researching and writing this book, do you still feel hopeful?
I am hopeful. I see some solutions out there. There are some very interesting modeling exercises done to project how much we need to change to have a positive effect on the Earth's ecosystems. Certainly, we're having a huge and mostly negative effect now, but as more and more people understand the small things they can do to make a difference, I think they will, and I'm hopeful that will generate a large change in our natural world.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
John Marsliff is a professor of environmental and forest sciences at the University of Washington and is the author or co-author of several books on environmental topics. His most recent, the one we've just been talking about, is called In Search of Meadowlarks, Birds, Farms, and Food in Harmony with the Land. If you have experience maybe as a farmer yourself that fits into this conversation, let us know about it. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, gym goers were forced to explore different options for getting their exercise in as the pandemic broke out. And while some people can't wait to go back to the gym, others are finding alternative options they'd like to keep around. We'll look at the future of fitness and we'll want to hear from you. You can get started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Did you change your fitness routine? Was it a temporary change or are there things you're going to keep around for the future? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The number of positive COVID-19 cases has been increasing in Wisconsin, while the number of deaths from the virus seems to be slowing down. Coming up, we'll take a look at what's going on and what it might tell us about the future course of the illness here in the state. First, just a month ago, trying to find some dumbbells or other home fitness gear would have been quite a challenge. Stores saw record sales, online retailers ran out of stock, and one Georgia iron company began mass-producing kettlebells just to respond to demand. Since then, some gyms and studios have reopened, but not everyone is planning to return. The future of the fitness industry could look different as people spend their money on home gym setups or find out that doing push-ups is cheaper and maybe just as satisfying. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you were a regular gym goer prior to the quarantine, what was it like for you to adjust your routine? Did you find other ways to work out at home? Did you exercise outside? Has time away from your gym or classes made you think differently about your routine? Or are you looking forward to going full on back at the gym? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Natalia Petrozella is a historian of contemporary American politics and culture and an associate professor of history at the New School. She's a journalist and author with a forthcoming book on American fitness culture called Fit Nation, How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. Natalia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
You've tracked changes over American history when it comes to how we exercise. this COVID-19 moment in our fitness. This is a big deal, right? This is a big change.
Yeah, I think it is a really big change for a lot of reasons. And one of the seismic shifts, I know for me who studies this and a lot of gym goers too, was that we so often think about going to the gym as one of the best health promoting activities that we can undertake. But then all of a sudden COVID happened and the gym became one of the worst places to be if you really cared about public health. So I think that was one like big overarching shift that's changing our ideas about exercise that I think will be with us for a while.
This isn't the first time in our history, I've seen you write elsewhere, that we've turned our attention to home fitness. Can you tell us a little bit about big moments for working out at home in our recent history?
Yeah, well, it depends what you think of as recent, but you know, at least two big moments had more to do with technology than public health. And one was the proliferation of television sets for Americans. So in the 1950s, as you know, the growth in who had TVs was exponential. You had the rise of television fitness, shows like Jack LaLanne, Debbie Drake, some listeners will remember. And then the next sort of big hit with that was VHS in the 1980s. And Jane Fonda really paved the way there. But, you know, it wasn't just Jane Fonda, and as VCRs became less expensive, people were buying up workout VHSs to do at home. So I think those are two really big moments that have different drivers than the one that we're seeing now in terms of people exercising at home.
What led to this big predominance, again, pre-COVID-19, of gyms and fitness centers? It seems like those became the definition of working out. Staying at home and doing it just didn't seem quite right anymore.
Yeah, well, I don't want to underplay how popular things like Peloton and Mirror and YouTube, Daily Burn, those have been growing for a long time since our streaming technologies have gotten better and better. But at the same time, you know, people have seen fitness studios and gyms as really sites of community and places that, yes, they're going to sweat and burn calories and do something physical, but that they're getting something more than the physical out of it. And, you know, about, I don't know, now 20 years ago, people were talking about bowling alone and the decline of kind of bowling leagues as civic spaces for Americans. I would say that one important site that has come up in its stead is the gym or the studio. And you hear people talking about, you know, my tribe, my community, my posse, et cetera, associated with the people they do like stationary cycling classes with. And I think that's really important. And people are thinking about that as, you know, technology makes it relatively feasible to do a lot of the physical work at home if you have the space. But people are realizing, wow, I really miss seeing people and, you know, either competing with them or finding camaraderie with them or sometimes both.
Natalia Petrozella is with us from the New School. She has a forthcoming book called Fit Nation, How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. We're talking to her about how fitness is changing amid the COVID-19 outbreak and what it could look like in the future. Natalia, what have you seen people really turning to in this time? What are some of the things you would highlight as super big trends since this all started?
Yeah, well, I would say you both see really big trends on the very high end, things like Mirror, which just got acquired by Lululemon and a big acquisition, and also Peloton, which is probably like the highest end of this. But then at the same time, you've seen this boom in often free workouts on Instagram Live and on YouTube. And so I think that's really interesting to see that home fitness has really seen a huge expansion across all price points. And so I think that's important to think about in terms of access. Often we can think about home fitness as being something that's purely a luxury. There was a big boom in the construction of home gyms in the early 90s, and it was like the ultimate status symbol to have the space and the money to build your own private gym. But now as technology has made certain forms of home exercise, you know, much cheaper, if not free, you see working out at home both being something that anyone can do, even if they can't afford a gym, but also which people are doing to show status in a different way, buying that new, very expensive gadget with a subscription service.
I've seen some people, this is just anecdotal now, some people saying, hey, wait a minute, when I work out at home, nobody can see me. And for some of those people, that's a positive. They don't have to worry about what they look like when they exercise. How big a factor is that?
Yeah, that's always been a big positive for exercise at home, especially as, you know, I do think it's changing, but a lot of people who aren't, you know, yet exercising a lot or who might be insecure about what they look like have felt that, you know, I want to exercise and be healthy and fit, but I feel like you need to look like you're already fit to walk into a gym. And so they feel like it's a sort of catch 22. And so home exercise actually provides this very liberating opportunity to exercise without not under the watchful gaze of other people who might be kind of checking you out and, you know, whether you think it's real or not, possibly judging you.
On the other hand, and I think some people go into the gym with this attitude of, hey, I'm going to go to the gym and I know I don't look great and that's okay. And maybe that's a boost for the rest of our lives that we don't care what other people are seeing. We're just out there and we're going to do it.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of the sentiment that, again, depends on the person, depends on the gym, but there are definitely fitness communities where people kind of show up like, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing. And it's actually not about even, I want to look a different way. It's about being here and feeling good and doing what I can do and, you know, screw it. And I think that's like much more positive than, you know, I have to look a particular way or I might look this way today, but I'm working to be thinner or to look more conventionally fit. I think that's something we should push back on.
This is an unanswerable question at this point. The question of are people going to go back to the gym? What kind of questions do you have? What kind of things are you looking at to see how we are going to answer that as a society and I guess individually too?
Yeah, you know, of course, in terms of data, it's unanswerable right now. But I do think it's really interesting as people are thinking about, you know, the kind of risk benefit analysis and that what are the things about going to the physical gym that I value so much that are not accessible in a home experience that I would take a public health risk to go back for. And I see those at least, and again, this is anecdotal at this point, falling into at least two buckets. One is very practical. It's about really equipment. Like, you know, very few people have room for like a squat rack and multiple cardio machines. And they want that equipment that they can't get in a, you know, in at home. But on the other hand, there's something much less tangible, which is the community aspect and both, you know, kind of competing with other people, seeing other people, showing off, like just being around other people as a space that is like a church or a synagogue or a school or a public square, any of those places where we go to formally or informally connect to other people. And so I think that depending on how much you yearn for that, either the equipment or that more slippery experience of being around other people, that will be something that determines people's decisions. The other piece I think is also how comfortable gyms are going to be, or how comfortable gyms will make people that they're taking necessary precautions, right? Are gyms cleaning all the time? Are they saying, you know, we're having the attendance in classes? Are they putting up those dividers between the cardio machines? Are they offering or requiring gloves, masks? I think all of that is probably really going to shape people's decisions as well.
One more trend that I've seen anecdotally reported again, Natalia, that I wanted to ask about before we let you go is it seems like a lot more people are getting outside and embracing that relatively COVID safe environment of getting in the outdoors.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that on the one hand, yes, you're right. We are seeing more and more people taking up running and cycling and hiking and all of these sort of, you know, very non-technological old school ways of being active. And that's great. And I think it's interesting to see that happen at the same time that we're also seeing the rise of the highest tech fitness really taking off. So, you know, I'm hoping that that will continue because I think that that's really great. And it tends to be free also. I'm hoping that that will also bring our attention to the different accesses to public space that people have in different neighborhoods. You know, I live in New York City. In, you know, more expensive neighborhoods, they're beautifully safe, manicured running trails by the river. That is much less the case if you go to neighborhoods with fewer resources. And I'm hoping that this new embrace of like outdoor exercise hopefully will put some urgency behind, you know, having some equity around access to those kinds of spaces.
Natalia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Natalia Petrozella is a historian of contemporary American politics and culture and an associate professor of history at the New School. She's also a journalist and author. Her forthcoming book on American fitness culture is called Fit nation. Coming up, we'll talk about what's up with the surge in positive COVID-19 cases around the state, potential face mask mandates, and more. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development about what's happening with the state's unemployment claims. Now, today's numbers from the State Department of Health Services show that Wisconsin added 495 cases of COVID-19. That's out of about 12,500 tests. There were also nine deaths, the first reported since July 3rd. Cases have been on the rise since the middle of June. A lot of that increase attributed to young people. In fact, people in their 20s make up about a quarter of the state's 32,000 cases now. In Milwaukee County, officials say the average age of a coronavirus patient is 36, down from 52 back in March. Meanwhile, Dane County will now require all residents to wear masks in any enclosed building except for restaurants and their own homes. The order also requires people to wear masks if they go to another person's home. The city of Milwaukee may soon impose a mask requirement as well. In his first coronavirus briefing since June 23rd, Governor Evers says he's considering a statewide mandate to wear masks, though he says Republicans would likely challenge it and the Supreme Court would probably strike it down. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
What is your read, Amanda, on the latest numbers and trends when it comes to COVID-19 here in the state?
Well, the last time you had me on the program was right before Memorial Day weekend, and to some extent, it feels a bit like deja vu. That day, May 22nd, we had almost 15,000 cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin, and we had had about 500 deaths. And in the past 6 weeks, we have now accumulated about another 17,000 cases and about 500 new test positives today. So really, the situation doesn't feel much different than when I talked to you 6 weeks ago.
A lot of people point toward kind of diverging curves, cases going up quite a bit, deaths seeming to level off some. What do you make of that? Can we read that as good news, that part of the story?
That's true. We do have fewer deaths occurring right now than probably when I talked to you 6 weeks ago. I think the thing we need to keep in mind is that if the people who are now getting COVID out in the community tend to be younger, they may not be at as high a risk of death. We also, have to understand there could be a lag between when cases get diagnosed and when those deaths occur.
And another concern is, even if those younger people are safe from the disease, they probably know some older people, people with compromised immune systems, so that surge in young people this week could lead to bad news down the road, potentially.
Exactly. I think there's, two things to keep in mind. What you just mentioned, that the individuals that may be younger that are now getting diagnosed with COVID, they could still pass that infection on to other people that are at high risk of complications, other family members or other community members. And it may take a few weeks for that to translate to those individuals being diagnosed, and then, a little bit more time before they would be hospitalized or unfortunately die from this infection. The other point is that even though deaths may be down, that shouldn't be our only focus point. Individuals who are getting diagnosed, even if they're young, we still don't know a lot about the long-term complications of this infection. We can't rule out that there won't be significant morbidity or long-term symptoms or other problems that occur when young people get this infection.
That's an important point. I think we look at the overall cases a lot. We look at the deaths a lot. There's a middle ground where people get it and it's not a walk in the park. What do we know about the health damage this can do, even if it doesn't actually kill somebody?
I think we are, it's been 6 months about since this outbreak started globally. So we really are early on in terms of the long-term outlook of what this infection is going to mean for individuals, you know, even if they don't die from it. And so, you know, in some cases, people are having symptoms for a long time. They get better and then those symptoms return, you know, and I think we don't know a lot about what the long-term complications are going to be in terms of lung damage or other kind of issues that could come with this infection in the long term.
We are talking about the latest COVID-19 numbers in Wisconsin and what to watch out for. Amanda Simonek is with us from the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. Amanda, I've been reading about so-called super spreader events. People have profiled a bar in East Lansing, a choir practice in California, an indoor surprise party in Texas as places where the disease spread to a lot of people. From what we know now, what kind of events, what kind of settings worry you the most as far as transmission?
Yeah, definitely indoor settings in which people are not social distancing, not wearing masks, and are indoors and enclosed spaces that are not well ventilated for extended periods of time. That combination of factors really does set up the possibility of a super spreading type event. But even outside of some kind of super spreading event, those are just the combination of factors that are going to most lead to transmission of this infection.
And speaking of masks, we've got Dane County now having a mask mandate. Milwaukee maybe soon to do that. They're considering it in the city. What do you want to say to people about the benefit of mask wearing, whether it's required or not in their community?
I think anyone who's going to potentially be around people outside of their household should bring a mask. You know, it's a good practice. My own household, we grab a mask before we leave. And even if we're going to go out to the park, because there could be the potential that you unexpectedly would be next to somebody, you know, who's less than 6 feet away from you. And so when we wear masks, this keeps the droplets that we expel either just through talking or coughing or singing or laughing, they keep those droplets with us behind our mask. And so it really lowers the amount of virus that's getting expelled into the environment in the first place. And the more people who do this, the better off we are in terms of containing those droplets out in public.
You're one of the administrators of the Dear Pandemic Facebook page. You're working to inform and answer people's questions. What kind of questions are you getting these days from the public?
Well, since states have been reopening across Wisconsin, you know, we are getting questions ranging from, is it okay to visit with grandparents, to if I have to travel and stay in a hotel, what kind of precautions are being taken in hotel chains, and what can I do personally once I arrive there to reduce my risk to the best extent possible? If I have to fly, how what are the latest guidelines around airplanes and airports, and what do I need to do? So a lot of practical day-to-day questions, you know, should my child play sports? Should they go to camp? You know, how can I be smart about slowly and cautiously expanding my social circle?
In our last minute or so, I want to get your thoughts on one of the biggest questions. It's not that long until schools theoretically reopen. What kind of guidelines are you hoping people are keeping in mind here?
Well, what I'd love to see is that communities prioritize schools and the possibility that we'll be in a good place in terms of our total case burden at the time that school is going to start. And so I think that means making choices to reduce transmission in other settings. And so, you know, as at an individual level, you can be choosing when you are going to decide who to interact with or what activities to engage in, you know, trying to, we have this Dear Pandemic principle of stay smart this summer. So think about space, wearing a mask, air, keeping your interactions outdoors, reducing the number of people that you interact with, and the duration of time that you interact. So we can apply those principles to anything that we are considering doing, and try to think, oh, if I want to go to a movie, maybe going to a drive-in with people in my household is going to be lower risk than, you know, going indoors in a theater for a couple hours. But then not just on the individual level, but on the community level, I think we need to prioritize ways that we can reduce community spread. So if that means that we aren't going to be in indoor spaces like restaurants and bars for the next few months, we should do that, because we should be putting, you know, the possibility of being in a good place for kids to return to school ahead of some of these other activities, I think.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology at the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. We checked with her for the latest on the coronavirus here in Wisconsin, including the rise in positive cases and the slowing down for now, apparently, in the number of deaths. If you have questions related to COVID-19, let us know what they are via our Wisconsin project, as in WHYSconsin. Find more info at WPR.org. We're Wisconsin Public Radio, and I know most of the people listening to this show at any given time are probably listening here in Wisconsin. And of course, we get callers on the show who are listening to our broadcast signal in our neighboring states, Michigan, Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and at WPR.org through the WPR app. I know people sometimes are tuning in anywhere around the world. But here's a story we heard about the reach of our broadcast signal that surprised me. Ezra Wall, our regional manager in La Crosse, shared this email from a listener. Quote, last Tuesday afternoon while tuning around on my radio, I was surprised to find a pretty strong signal on 90.3 FM, which is normally empty in this area. I was certainly surprised when I heard your identification and found out I was listening to Wisconsin. That email was from a self-described radio hobbyist named Nigel in Alberta in Canada. He apparently picked up the signal from WHLA, our station in La Crosse. Nigel goes on, I don't expect to hear from many listeners in Alberta, so I thought I'd drop you a line and let you know your signal made it out this way. So, of course, I hit the maps. The distance from La Crosse to the listener's town in Alberta, just over 1,000 miles as the crow flies, over 1,100 miles as the car drives. To put that in terms that trained radio engineers use, that's a really long way for a signal to reach. If you're listening at a great distance in any way, email us. Ideas at WPR.org. Tell us about it. Nigel, thanks for listening. This is Central Time.